The conservative revolution must emerge as a predominantly spiritual phenomenon, Avolo insists. In Australia, some movements have paid insufficient attention to this fundamental. Others have been too closely attached to outdated and inadequate religious forms, such as the National Civic Council and National Action and the Australian League of Rights. Avola, naturally, focuses especially upon Italy, as he looks for historical forms that might be the basis for an integration that will immediately leave them behind. For him, these are the ancient Roman world and certain aspects of medieval civilization. This prompts the question of what forms we in Australia should seek as supports, and immediately it must be stressed that for us Australian history cannot be viewed as beginning with the brave seamen who discovered our continent only a few centuries ago. For us, despite the barrage of contemporary propaganda to the contrary, Australia remains a fundamentally British nation. Thus our history extends back to the foundations of Britain itself, and its four kingdoms of England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland. Our supports will be found from a period of two millennia. The basis of sovereignty. Avola's second chapter is one of his most important. He proceeds from the conviction that the principle of the true state is itself founded upon transcendence. As soon as Avola moves downwards from this metaphysical point of origin, his formulations require careful critical examination. For example, he admires the pure power of command, the almost mystical power and auctoritas inherent in one who had the function and quality of leader, a leader in the religious and warrior order as well as in the order of the patrician family, the gens. Here, already, is a possible weakness in Avola. Himself by nature a Kshatriya, he tends to wrongly annex for his caste the superior authority of the Brahmins, just as, in places, he demeans the Brahmins by confusing them with priests who he sees as usurpers of the original royal authority. Of the principle of sovereignty, Avola writes that it is also necessary to recognize its attribute of absoluteness. Such an absoluteness can only belong to the one divine source, irrespective of what name is given to this source. Avola tends, however, at times, to transfer this absoluteness to forms which appeal to his strongly masculine, knightly and warrior temperament. Yet, no matter how valuable they may be, such forms remain contingent and limited, not universal. This tendency to absolutize the contingent is the occupational hazard of the modes of dogmatic religion which have proceeded from the Middle East. We can observe among the three peoples of the book three forms of this error: the absolutization of a people, of a prophet and of a sacred scripture. Avola correctly identifies the principle of sovereignty as the point of stability and the natural center of the entire organism. The essential political task in Australia at the present time is to safeguard and then strengthen and even re-establish the only center we possess, which is the monarchy, Christian and British, which we currently share with the mother country and some other nations. The Republican presidency, which is being vigorously promoted by powerful influences, as well as by numerous wiseacres, cannot provide such a center, because it is not authorized by a transcendent origin. Princeps legibus solutus is a maxim quoted approvingly by Avola, but it, too, needs qualification. Strictly, it applies only to the leader, or monarch, who lives and governs in accordance with the mandate of heaven, as Chinese tradition puts it. Royal dynasties, emperors, houses can lose their tay, and then it becomes right that they be replaced by fresh blood. Unlucky the generation on whom the burden of replacement falls, however, as such transitions are fraught with instability and danger. Avola rejects emphatically the modern heresy that the state is the expression of society. The anagogical end of the state is completely denied by the social or communal view of its formation. Nor, he argues, is it the chief purpose of the state to bring worldly happiness or pleasure. Avola places much store on the theory of the regression of the castes and the claim that we are living in the last phase of the fourth and darkest age. He sees the decline as having begun when the rulers lost their authorizing link with the worlds above. Later in history, this line leads, if not to the imperium, to the divine right of kings, where there were no groups created by the power of a right, there were orders, aristocracies, political classes defined by disciplines and dignities. Then the line was broken, and the decadence of the state ID ended with the inversion through which the world of the demos and the materialized masses emerged on the political horizon, engaging in the struggle for power. This picture of deterioration is important for us, because it reminds us that even the monarchical political orders of the period of European greatness and expansion were themselves seriously deficient. This suggests that Australian monarchists today need to recover a concept of royalty that exceeds in dignity anything recorded in British history. It may be that such a concept can be found in the ancient cultures of Egypt, India, and China. Much more questionable is Evola's attempt to unite his image of the state to manliness. The state is under the masculine aegis, while society and, by extension, the people or demos are under the feminine aegis. Evola's attempt to justify this from mythology appears to depend on a selective approach to ancient myths. His approach parallels that espoused by Melbourne psychologist Ronald Conway in The Great Australian Stupor and Land of the Long Weekend. Conway takes over from historian of sexuality Gordon Rattray Taylor the model of four psychological modes into which human beings, their behaviors and communities formed by those behaviors, can be classified. He idealizes the patrist conservative at the expense of the patrist authoritarian, the matrist permissive and the fraternalist anarchic. It seems likely, however, that a fifth mode should be included, which I designate as the matrist creative, and that normality should be seen to reside in the wedding of the patrist conservative and matrist creative. Both Conway and Evola are clearly very aware of the gulf between the higher masculine and the lower masculine, but each, through some fault of temperament, has failed to acknowledge a corresponding dichotomy between the higher feminine and the lower feminine. Thus, when Evola asserts that both democracy and socialism ratify the shift from the masculine to the feminine and from the spiritual to the material and the promiscuous, he has in mind the lower feminine only and has temporarily forgotten the comparable imperfection of the lower masculine. Evola also warns against an insufficient kind of patriotism. The notions of nation, fatherland and people, despite their romantic and idealistic halo, essentially belong to the naturalistic and biological plane and not the political one. He contrasts the masses, who can be easily mobilized by patriotic motifs, with men who differentiate themselves as bearers of a complete legitimacy and authority, bestowed by the idea and by their rigorous, impersonal adherence to it. The idea must be the true fatherland for these men. Evola tends to disparage adherence to the same land, language or blood. Perhaps stock and blood are more important than he admits, being the bodies in which the soul of the state can incarnate. Even Evola, writing only 8 years after the end of World War II, may have been traumatized by the intense anti-Nazism of that time. His rejection of democracy is trenchant, when a sovereignty is no longer allowed other than one that is the expression and the reflection of the will of the nation, it is almost as if a creature overtook its creator. He traces the inconsistency and, most of all, the cowardice of those who in our time constitute the political class to the shift from monarchical and aristocratic orders to demagogues and to the so-called servants of the nation who presume to represent the people and who acquire various offices or positions of power by flattering and manipulating the masses. Then occurs the phenomenon of action through pseudo-myths, formulas lacking any objective truth and that appeal to the sub-intellectual dimension and passions of individuals and the masses. The current campaign for Aboriginal reconciliation is an example. Fantasy novels, such as The Lord of the Rings and Terry Goodkin's Sword of Truth series, represent a yearning in the souls of modern people to escape from democratic degradation back to the clear air of the true state. Russell Kirk also noted the importance of modern fantasy literature in Enemies of the Permanent Things. Evola also noted the attempt to create a counter-state by the forces of subversion, a realization of the idea is already present on the other front. He had in mind the recently formed United Nations organization, which he correctly saw as lacking authorization by transcendence. Half a century later, the danger of the New World Order is much greater, as Australia's ratification of the International Criminal Court has just recently shown. Those who will not be ruled by kings will end up being ruled by tyrants. Person, justice, and freedom. Evola names liberalism as the origin of the various interconnected forms of global subversion. He sees the essence of liberalism as individualism. it mistakes the person for the individual. The nonsensical theory of egalitarianism depends upon this confusion. A. Voller defines a person as an individual who is differentiated through his qualities, endowed with his own face, his proper nature, and a series of attributes that make him who he is, that make him fundamentally unequal. This leads to a consideration of natural rights or human rights. A. Voller points out that the principle according to which all human beings are free and enjoy equal rights by nature is truly absurd, due to the very fact that by nature they are not the same. There may be such a thing as the dignity of the human person, but it admits to different degrees. Thus, justice means to attribute to each and every one of these degrees a different right and a different freedom. A. Voller is a champion of discrimination, a just discrimination that recognizes the ancient principle to each his own. Defense of personhood against the atomization of humanity into faceless individuals requires the recognition that man comes before society and not the reverse. A. Voller also places personhood as superior to membership of a nation. The perfection of the human being is the end to which every healthy social institution must be subordinated. This perfection must be conceived on the basis of a process of individuation and progressive differentiation. At the top of the pyramidal structure of the true state, A. Voller rather vaguely imagines the absolute person, the supremely realized person who represents the end, and the natural center of gravity, of the whole system, a dominating superpersonality. Here he is in danger of forgetting the preeminence of the transcendent. The lives of sages such as Sri Ramana Maharshi and Sheikh Alawi indicate that the top of the pyramid lies outside this world. A. Voller upholds the right of the nation over humanity, over and against all the forms of individualistic disintegration, international mixture and proletarization. As regards the question of property, he castigates economic liberalism for engendering various forms of capitalist exploitation and cynical, antisocial plutocracy, but also castigates the French revolutionaries' attack on the ancien regime because it broke the organic connection between personhood and property, social function and wealth, and between a given qualification or moral nobility and the rightful and legitimate possession of goods. These developments enabled the communist attack on the very principle of private property, since whenever there is no higher legitimization of ownership, it is always possible to wonder why some people have property and others do not, or why some people have earned for themselves privileges and social preeminence, while lacking something that would make them stand out and above everybody else in an effective and sensible manner. By contrast, ancient and primitive man essentially obeyed those in whom he perceived a saturation of mana. The lesson from this part of A. Voller's book is that the Australian right must courageously champion discrimination, hierarchy, caste and personhood and find ways of showing ordinary persons how a society based on such principles will bring them more real benefit than the utopian dreams of egalitarians. Totalitarianism. A. Voller points out the fundamental distinction between the traditional, organic state, based upon transcendent authority, and the modern totalitarian state. A state is traditional and organic when it has a center that shapes the various domains of life in an efficacious way when, by virtue of a system of hierarchical participation, every part within its relative autonomy performs its function and enjoys an intimate connection with the whole. Such a state is sympathetic to pluralism and decentralization, which can be accentuated in proportion to the degree to which the center enjoys a spiritual and even transcendent character, a sovereign equilibrating power and a natural prestige. In such a state there is an inner order of single freedoms, an immanence of general law that guides and sustains people without coercing them. A. Voller notes the importance of oaths in traditional societies. The oath of loyalty was regarded as a true sacrament in the feudal world. By contrast, a totalitarian state is a counterfeit of the organic ideal. Unity is imposed from the outside by a power that is exclusively and materially political. There is a tendency towards uniformity and intolerance of any partial form of autonomy and any degree of freedom, for any intermediate body between the center and the periphery. This in turn engenders a kind of sclerosis, a monstrous hypertrophy of the entire bureaucratic administrative structure, leading to an insolent intrusion of the public sphere into the private domain. A super-organized, centralized economy makes totalitarianism a school of servility, in which there is a sort of intrinsic and gloomy enjoyment of this relentless leveling process. Thus, totalitarian rule destroys quality, articulated forms, castes and classes, the values of personhood, true freedom, daring and responsible initiative and heroic feats. Democrats tend to publicize an alleged antithesis between liberal democracy and totalitarianism, whereas the truth appears to be that such democracy is a phase in the decline from the true state into the tyranny of totalitarianism. Thus, Democrats are happy to give much publicity to George Orwell, whose Animal Farm in 1984 brilliantly exposed the evil of totalitarianism, but they tend to be much less enthusiastic about Alexander Solzhenitsyn, whose series of great novels culminating in The Red Wheel not merely rivals Orwell's depiction of the horror, but also advocates a return to traditional verities including religious orthodoxy. The Australian right needs to note the difference between the two writers and to stress that the sovereign, acting in the service of God, is a better protector from tyranny than the democratic politician. Sons of the People. Avola sees another extreme consequence of democracy to be Bonapartism, which he defines as a despotism based on a democratic view, which it denies de facto while fulfilling it in theory. Many a modern dictator, large or small, comes under this heading. The danger of such figures is well indicated by Avola, since he personifies the will of the people, which is conceived as the political ultima ratio. The leader ends up claiming for himself an unlimited authority and regarding all the intermediate political bodies and all the branches of government as completely dependent on the central power, which alone is believed to legitimately represent the people. Orwell's portrait of Big Brother attacked this kind of dictatorship. Avola further distinguishes the true king from the Bonapartist despot by considering their relationships with those whom they rule, while the traditional view of sovereignty and authority sees it characterized by distance from the people, and the feeling of distance induces in the inferiors a sense of veneration, a natural respect and disposition to obedience and loyalty towards the leaders. The Bonapartist despot is enslaved to the complex of popularity and appeals to the lowest levels of human beings. Bread and circuses, or the modern equivalents. In considering dictatorship, a mode of rule he finds but rarely justified in history, Avola points out that, according to traditional thought, what matters is that a man be valued and recognized in terms of the idea and the principle he upholds, and not vice versa. Thus, within a properly constituted aristocratic order, we should admire a noble for being one in whom a tradition and a special spiritual race shine forth whose greatness is due not to his human virtues, but rather to the principle, the idea and a certain regal impersonality that he embodies. In this context, Avola dismisses Machiavelli's Prince as one whose authority no longer comes from above, its foundation being mere worldly strength. Here the leader does not consider the higher faculties that can be reawakened in his subjects, he harbors contempt and a fundamental pessimism towards people in general, on the basis of an alleged political realism. Such a leader also lacks a true respect for himself and his own dignity. In Australia, the kind of adulation felt in some quarters for people as diverse as Paul Keating, Pauline Hanson, and Sir William Dean reminds us of the temptations the general populace may experience to draw towards themselves the son or daughter of the people. Avola does not, by the way, neglect to pay respect to the military genius and achievements of Napoleon Bonaparte, but associates these with the heroism of the Dux or Imperator, a figure carefully distinguished in ancient Rome from the Rex. The lesson for the Australian right here is that it must seek a national leader who embodies the aristocratic sense of quality that comes hand in hand with a sense of humility before the awesome presence of God. A populist leader will be insufficient. A demonic economy nothing in excess. Substin et abstin. These are two of the traditional sayings Avola invokes in his examination of the modern glorification of work in our demonized economy. In traditional societies, individuals still lived in the station allotted to them by life. In those societies, an individual contained his need and aspirations within natural limits, he did not yearn to become different from what he was, and thus he was innocent of that alienation decried by Marxism. Avola also refers to the Thomist and Lutheran teaching that the acquisition of goods should be restricted and that work and the quest for profit are justifiable only in order to acquire a level of wealth corresponding to a person's status in life. He compares this traditional lifestyle of restraint and modesty with the pathological behavior of the modern world in which the importance of the economy is grossly exaggerated, so as to exercise a hypnotic tyranny over consumers whose appetites have been artificially inflamed. The true antithesis, Avola insists, is between a system in which the economy rules supreme and a system in which the economy is subordinated to extra-economic factors, within a wider and more complete order, such as to bestow a deep meaning upon human life and foster the development of its highest possibilities. Avola counters the utilitarian argument that the development of modern commerce and industry has improved the standard of living by pointing out that the qualities that matter the most in a man and make him who he is often rise in harsh circumstances and even in conditions of indigence and injustice, since they represent a challenge to him, testing his spirit. Avola sees the task ahead as being to deproletarize the view of life and calls for a metanoia, an inner transformation that will strike at the heart of the hegemony of work and regain for man his inner freedom. As regards the state itself, he suggests that autarky may be an ethical precept. It is better to renounce the allure of improving general social and economic conditions and to adopt a regime of austerity than to become enslaved to foreign interests. This, of course, was a key position taken by the great Portuguese leader Dr. Oliveira Salazar, whose life and philosophy deserves careful study. The overthrow of his successor, Dr. Marcelo Caetano, by the Spinola coup in 1974 was one of the tragedies of modern Europe, and of southern Africa. The full story has perhaps not yet been told in English. Avola also makes an important distinction between work and action. It is action that is performed by those of the Kshatriya class, by ascetics, rulers, artists, explorers, warriors, scientists, diplomats, philosophers and theologians. The challenge for the Australian right, in the context of this tyranny of a mercantile outlook, is to articulate a comprehensive vision for Australians which will have the capacity to win their hearts away from hedonism and the lust for wealth, which is currently symbolized so effectively by the domination of gambling facilities of all kinds. History and its misuse. Avola attacks a tradition of historicism, originating with Hegel, which has given an abnormal emphasis to history, to the advantage of subversive forces. He laments the disastrous shift from a civilization of being to a civilization of becoming, characterized by change, flux and contingency. He also points out that the ideas of history, progress and evolution have been closely associated. Monarchists will enjoy his observation that the anathema of being anti-historical and outside history is cast against those who still remember the way things were before and who call subversion by its name, instead of conforming to the processes that are precipitating the world's decline. From this discussion, Avola moves to a consideration of the different histories that exist within the history of nations. What is required is a wise choice of traditions. Avola condemns a pseudo-patriotic historiography in Italy which, due to its partisan spirit, suggestions and catchphrases, precludes the objective comprehension of many aspects of the past. He even writes of fabricated history, the alibi that revolutionary liberalism, democracy and the thinkers of Freemasonry and the Enlightenment have created for their own benefit. The Australian right needs to rescue much from the history of the British and of Australia which has been overlooked, while contending intelligently with partisan accounts of the treatment of the Aborigines, which are designed to enable political change leading to a republic which will be a province of the New World Order. Warrior and Bourgeois. Avola's most self-revealing chapter is his study of the different ways of looking at war and the role of the warrior found in traditional heroic societies and in modern bourgeois societies. It was only in reading it that I realized how much I myself am a product of mercantile politics, and why men like Sir Walter Scott and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle wrote novels like Quentin Durwood and Sir Nigel. Avola points out that militarism is the bête noire of many democrats, and that it is a word at times misapplied to noble warrior behavior. His account, in this context, of modern democracies seems, in the light of September 11, to be remarkably up to date. He notes that their view is that in society the primary element is the bourgeois type and the bourgeois life during times of peace. Such a life is dominated by the physical concern for safety, well-being and material wealth, with the cultivation of letters and the arts serving as a decorative frame. The military is a mere instrument. Democratic ideology proclaims that armies should be used only as an international police force to maintain the peace. Avola dryly comments that in most cases this amounts to allowing wealthy nations to live undisturbed. The armed forces are used to impose or retain an economic hegemony, to gain new markets and to acquire raw materials, and to create new space for capital-seeking investment and profit. This explains the deep, widespread mistrust toward the ideological background of the recent wars, a background shaped by many lies and much propaganda. In short, the bourgeois democratic lifestyle leads to hypocrisy and deceit, corruption on the grand scale. Avola contrasts such a civilization with that of which the ancient order of Teutonic Knights and the Prussian tradition were recent examples. In such a world, the warrior was not at the service of the merchant class but ruled over it. His lifestyle had its own spirituality and ethics, love for hierarchy, relationships of obedience and command, courage, feelings of honor and loyalty, specific forms of active impersonality capable of producing anonymous sacrifice, frank and open relationships from man to man, from one comrade to another, from leader to follower. In such a climate of heroic integrity, war did not have a merely negative meaning. Avola points out that there is an identity between spirit and superior civilization and the warrior's role. In the traditional world, we encounter the interpretation of life as a perennial struggle between metaphysical powers, between Uranian forces of light and order and telluric, dark forces of chaos and matter. Traditional man yearned to fight this battle and to triumph in both the inner and outer worlds. Avola adds that there is an interdependence between the warrior idea and that of a certain asceticism, inner discipline and superiority toward or control of one's self. This was the foundation of a specific style that has largely been lost. He also reminds us that in many civilizations, even the hierarchies with a spiritual foundation either relied on hierarchies that were more or less warrior or reproduced their form. Then, when the original spiritual level could not be maintained, hierarchical structures of a warrior type constituted the armature of the major states, especially in the West. Thus, since the sensibility for purely spiritual values and dignities has become mostly atrophied among Western populations, the model of a military hierarchy is almost the only one that can still supply the basis for an upwardly striving lifestyle. That model still retains a certain prestige, since there is a heroic dimension in the Western soul that cannot be extirpated. One advantage of a heroic, as opposed to a bourgeois, civilization is its readiness to fight. There is a certain continuity of spirit and attitude, a common denominator in peace and in war that facilitates the shift from one state to the other. Thus, when a war breaks out, a nation is ready for it, and fights with a sufficient number of men who reproduce in a new form the warrior type. Avola also addresses the question of what role can be played by the heroic spirit in modern, total wars, in which science and technology have so drastically changed the human conditions of combat. Here he writes with a bleakness that he probably absorbed in part from Ernst Jung. Essentially, he calls for a quality of endurance through warfare that is comparable to elementary and unavoidable natural phenomena. Man must remain spiritually upright through extreme trials and destructions by developing in himself a new inner dimension of cold, lucid and complex heroism, including a sacrificial disposition. It seems clear that in Australia an effective movement of the right will need to honour the warrior lifestyle in both its deeds and its words. Ways must be found to rouse our manhood from the great Australian stupor that has perhaps resulted primarily from the bourgeois atmosphere. Ronald Conway pointed out that Australia most nearly approached an aristocratic political order in the two decades before World War I, when there was a society of quality that Martin Boyd captured well in his novels, which merit close study. Religious restoration. Hindu tradition teaches that there are four states in which human beings can exist: deep sleep, sleep, awakening and enlightenment or attainment. What we normally think of as our waking state is in fact sleep, and what we regard as sleep is deep sleep. It was in this tradition that Gurdjieff told those who came to his lectures that they were machines which could do nothing, because they were asleep. Evola does not mention this tradition in Men Among the Ruins, although he no doubt discusses it elsewhere. It is vital to an understanding of religion and, most especially, initiation. The processes of esoteric sacred tradition designed to wake initiates up. In my view, initiation is the prerogative of the Brahmin caste, and René Guénon was correct to state that the modern disaster had befallen Western Europe because the Church had lost its power to initiate. That loss is the greatest difficulty with which modern Europeans and Australians who seek to restore traditional society must contend. It has created a void which can only be filled by a new impulse from the worlds above. In another very important chapter, Evola begins by stressing that by tradition he does not refer to religious traditions in general or to the Catholic Christian tradition in particular, but to something wider, more austere and more universal than mere Catholicism. He acknowledges that in the past some conservative forces have been inspired by Catholicism, which gave a special chrism to the principles of authority and sovereignty. However, the true traditional spirit acknowledges a superior, metaphysical unity beyond the individual religious traditions. That position has been most succinctly and effectively expressed by Fritjof Schoen in The Transcendent Unity of Religions. Representatives of Catholicism and of Orthodoxy have tried in vain to disprove this perennialist thesis. Evola correctly warns that foolish persistence in religious exclusivity will impede efforts to engage in the restoration of traditional political order. Evola needs to be quoted at length here, as too many Australian Christians are resisting the essential metanoia. Despite the fact that every religious form has the right to a certain exclusivity in the area of its pertinence, the idea of this higher unity should be acknowledged by its most qualified representatives. The exclusivist position may not be maintained without the danger of discrediting the traditional Catholics who rigidly adhere to it. Nobody with a higher education can really believe in the axiom, there is no salvation outside the Church. This is a matter not of faith, but of either knowledge or ignorance. The current state of knowledge in matters of comparative religion, mythology and even ethnology requires a revision and an adequate widening of the intellectual horizons. Muslims should heed this warning as well as Christians. Evola also gives his attention to the problem of the relationship between the principle of sovereignty and the religious principle in general, but his adherence to the Ghibelline cause may have led him astray. He argues that, according to Ghibelline theology, the Holy Roman Empire was an institution of supernatural origin and character, like the Church. During the Middle Ages, the dignity of the kings themselves had an almost priestly nature. The Ghibelline emperors opposed the hegemonic claims of the clergy and claimed to have only God above themselves. The realization of the human person was believed to consist either in the path of action or in the path of contemplation. This was Dante's view. Thus, knighthood and the great knightly orders stood in relation to the empire in the same way in which the clergy and the ascetic orders stood in relation to the Church. Evola also points out that the title of pontiff, originating from the Latin word pontifex and denoting one who mediates transcendence into this world, was the title of Roman emperors. Thus, in the first few centuries of the current era, as well as in the Byzantine Empire, the clergy were subjected to the emperor in the theological domain, as is proved by the fact that it was to the emperor that the formulas of the church councils were submitted for their final decision and ratification. Evola clearly prefers this preeminence of empire over church to the model of the Guelph opposition, which sought to ensure that the church was the supreme power. In my view, however, neither faction was completely right. By nature, the Brahmin is superior to the Kshatriya. The latter needs the guidance of the former, not vice versa. Unfortunately, the Church lost its Brahminic capacity and thus forfeited any right to give directions to kings and emperors. Nevertheless, Kshatriyas continue to need guidance, an Arthur needs his Merlin, an Aragorn his Gandalf. It is very doubtful whether the Byzantine and Ghibelline emperors were initiated men, in which case their claims to have only God above them were of very dubious standing. The probable truth is that both church and empire were shells, in the sense in which Idris Shah uses the term in his book The Sufis. That is to say, they preserved forms from former initiatory groups without possessing the capacity of initiation itself. Hence, in the world of European kingdoms that emerged out of the Middle Ages, there was no perfect solution to the dilemma over which institution should have supreme power, church or state, and, inevitably, there was a continuing tug of war. Evola also developed further his critique of the Catholic Church, arguing that its capability of providing adequate support for a revolutionary conservative and traditionalist movement must be resolutely denied. He enumerated various failings of Catholicism and concluded that the direction it has taken is a descending and anti-traditional one, consisting of modernization and coming to terms with democracy, socialism and progressivism. Thus, the norm that must be followed is to travel an autonomous way, abandoning the Church to her destiny, considering her actual inability to bestow an official consecration on a true, great, traditional and super-traditional rite. My own view is that Australians of the right should be a little more magnanimous in their attitude to the Catholic Church and other churches and even other religions. These may have their faults, but we will have our faults too, for we cannot at present claim to be initiates, to be awakened men. All of us are like travelers lost in the dark. We can use what intelligence we have to help each other, but must remain honestly aware of the tentative nature of our own efforts. Let us pray that heaven will send down some future light to us or our descendants. Finally, Evola comments on the apparent discrepancies between what he misguidedly calls the nihilist teachings of Jesus in the Gospels and the kind of understanding necessary for effective rule of a kingdom or empire. Here, he seems to give insufficient weight to the obvious initiatory nature of much of the gospel message, tending to respond to texts as though they are to be taken literally when beyond doubt they are to be taken symbolically. For example, he objects to the famous exhortation, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's." He sees this as promoting a separation between human institutions and supernatural order which the Guelph faction was able to exploit. However, it surely refers to the fundamental difference between this world and the worlds above. The essential message is that the two worlds should not be confused. It is only if the profound initiatory teaching of the Gospels is taken literally that it tends to conflict with practical common sense in our ordinary conduct in this mundane world. Unreal Realisms, in his 11th chapter, Evola considers a variety of unsatisfactory responses to the unappealing and conformist world of the bourgeois. He rejects neorealism as the mistake of those who regard only the inferior degrees of reality as real and condemns psychoanalysis as a doctrine that divests and brands as unreal the conscious and sovereign principle of the person, considering as real instead the irrational, unconscious, collective and nocturnal dimension of the human being, every higher faculty being seen as derived and dependent. He gives a particularly adroit and succinct summary of existentialism. It proclaims the primacy of existence over being, instead of acknowledging that existence acquires a meaning only when it is inspired by something beyond itself. In this philosophy, existence is identified with the most shallow forms of life. This kind of existence is separated from any superior principle, made absolute and cherished in its anguished and lightless immediacy. That is an apt diagnosis of Albert Camus' interesting but poisonous novel The Outsider, but would not be fairly applied to the nobler novel The Plague, in which the failed Algerian metaphysician struck a truly tragic note. Evola also notes that the bourgeois pettiness can even infect monarchs, churchmen and communist demonstrators. Another inappropriate response to the bourgeois mentality that he identifies is an exaggerated appreciation of culture and intellectualism, associated with the growing, hypertrophic cerebralization of Western man, who is given too privileged a position in recent centuries to conceptual thought. In response to these false sallies, Evola calls for a more realistic opposition to the bourgeois spirit, which is oriented upward and includes a revival of the heroic and aristocratic virtues. We must remain upright, feeling the presence in life of that which leads beyond life. We need to recover a worldview based on an inner form and a sensibility endowed with an innate character which expresses instinctive certainty and a sense of a sure meaning of life. This is the premise for the emergence of new men and leaders capable of establishing a new political climate. This suggests that any effective political movement of the right in Australia will need to promote inner exploration in its followers, not merely pious prayer, but deeper forms of meditation and contemplation. The corporative workplace as a necessary step to the reassertion of control over the economy by the state, Eivolla recommends an end to classism and class struggle. His ideal is a corporative principle involving a community of work and productive solidarity, based on the principles of competence, qualification and natural hierarchy, with the overall system characterized by a style of active impersonality, selflessness and dignity. He recalls the medieval artisan corporations, guilds and craft fraternities, whose members enjoyed the status of freemen and also were very proud of belonging to their association. Such men felt love for their work, which was regarded as an art and an expression of one's vocation. They readily upheld the code of honor of their corporations. That world was turned upside down by the Industrial Revolution, which went hand in hand with the rise to power of usurious financial groups. Thus, says Eivolla, today the truly relevant and serious problem is that of the restraint that needs to be placed on the wild and unscrupulous struggle among various monopolies, and especially among the monopoly of goods and materials, the monopoly of money and the monopoly of labor. Eivolla is certain that only the state can effectively limit the power of these groups and that this can only happen where the state appears as a superordained power, capable of facing and defeating any subversive force. Australians should note here the overwhelming case for the retention of our monarchy. Yielding to the agitation for a republic will mean handing ourselves over to those who control these great monopolies, the barons or giants of the age. Our task, then, must be to breathe life back into the monarchy, by finding ways to rekindle heartfelt loyalty to the crown, and later in our history to effect the inauguration of a truly Australian monarchy, seeded, as it were, from the parent tree in Britain. Eivolla is emphatic that the struggle against a degenerate and arrogant capitalism must be waged from above. As regards solutions, he is opposed to forms of worker co-ownership, which he sees as tending to fatal inefficiency, particularly in the management of large companies, which are like large armies. However, he suggests that ways should be devised through which the worker could gradually become a small owner, by making him possessor of non-transferable stocks of his company corporation. Eivolla calls for the suppression of the worst type of capitalist, who is a parasitical recipient of profits and dividends. Instead, in a new cooperative system, the owner of the means of production should assume the function of responsible leader, technical manager and capable organizer of the business he runs, being surrounded by loyal workers who are free from trade union control. Eivolla understands well that in the varieties of what is essentially mechanical work it is very difficult to retain the character of art and of vocation and for the results of production to show any signature of the personhood of those who worked to manufacture them. This poses a problem similar to that encountered earlier in the phenomenon of total war caused by modern scientific, technological and industrial advances. Eivolla adopts a similar solution, seeking the emergence of a new type, characterized by a certain impersonality who will incarnate new forms of the anonymity and unselfishness that characterized ancient corporativism. Clearly, such a phenomenon could only appear in a noble and just state whose population as a whole had faith in the goodness and purposes of that state. Eivolla also favored a reconstructed parliamentary system in which the lower house is filled with representatives of the business, professional and trades corporations, whose task would mainly be the management of the state's economic affairs. Political concerns would largely be dealt with by the upper house, which would consist of men who embodied and could defend spiritual and national interests of prestige and power. One should belong to this superior house by designation from above and for life, almost as if it were an order, on the basis of one's natural dignity and inalienable qualification. Such discussions will make Australian men and women of the right aware of the magnitude of the challenge that lies before them, but certainly we cannot rest content with the current political structures as they operate. Occult Politics in his 13th chapter, in which Eivolla rightly acknowledges his considerable debt to René Guénon, the question is asked whether it is necessary to identify influences of a higher order behind the disastrous collapse around the world of traditionally articulated societies. Eivolla reminds us of how, for example, Catholic historiography used to regard history as the unfolding of divine providence, to which hostile forces are opposed, forces of evil, forces of the Antichrist, forces of the cosmos against forces of chaos. This is potentially sensational copy. However, Evola does not develop any kind of detailed and documented inquiry into the mystery of iniquity. Many readers may agree with me on the basis of their own personal experience that there does seem to be active in our world a superhuman being of evil, whose presence can be felt on occasions as not merely one of enormous and elemental power, but also one of a devastating hatred and conscious malignity. Evola carries out no research into this matter, perhaps preferring to keep metaphysics out of what is largely just a primer for political action. Instead, he uses the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, of whose authenticity he is clearly very skeptical, to allow him to raise another question, that of whether or not the disorder of recent times is accidental, since it corresponds to a plan, the phases and fundamental instruments of which are accurately described in the protocols. Thus, he focuses wholly on the question of whether or not there has been a worldly political conspiracy behind the world's calamities. He produces a fairly convincing case that there has been, but avoids the cliché of placing blame on the Jews and Masonry. Rather, he surmises that these groups themselves may have been used by a more concealed source. Evola also considers carefully the various instruments by which occult war appears to be waged: scientific suggestion and positivist propaganda, the tactic of replacement, the tactic of counterfeits, the encouragement of a useless traditionalism, the tactic of inversion, the tactic of ricochet, the scapegoat tactic, the tactic of deliberate misidentification of a principle with its representative, and the tactic of replacement infiltrations. Evola sensibly warns us against quixotic gallantries in this dangerous situation. Those movements of the past that intended to react against and stem the currents of national, social and moral dissolution often upheld dangerously unilateral positions, due to the lack of adequate discernment. This was a weakness that played into the enemy's hands. He concludes this chapter by adding, "There is little hope that anything may be saved when among the leaders of a new movement there are no men capable of integrating the material struggle with a secret and inexorable knowledge, one that stands on the side of the luminous principle of traditional spirituality." The Roman ideal related to Evola's discussion of the need for a choice of traditions within a nation's history is his comparison of the two dominant temperaments within the Italian soul, the Roman and the Mediterranean. A discussion interesting in itself, it also suggests that the Australian Rite may need to undertake a comparable analysis of the Australian soul. Evola begins by presenting two unexpected historical perspectives. He first argues that the heroic sacred world of early Roman Sparta was not perpetuated in the following classical civilization, from which, in turn, the Latin spirit and the doctrine of the unity of the peoples of Latin civilization derived. Next, he replaces the democratic image of the Axis Pact between Italy and Germany with a much more dignified interpretation, arguing that Germany retained aspects of the heroic sacred world longer than Greece or Italy. He suggests that the Axis could have spiritually strengthened both peoples with a reciprocal integration, if it had not been sabotaged partly by elements in Italy itself, even fascist cadres misled by the myth of the Risorgimento. Evola's depiction of the original Roman spirit deserves to be quoted at length, since it clearly reflects his own personal ideal and the temperament which gave him his perspective on life. Australians might be wise to draw up a similar inventory of the British spirit as the better part of their own national soul. Evola saw the Roman spirit as based on a human type characterized by self-control, an enlightened boldness, a concise speech and determined and coherent conduct, and a cold, dominating attitude exempt from personalism and vanity. To this Roman style belong virtus, in the sense not of moralism, but of virile spirit and courage, fortitudo and constantia, namely spiritual strength, sapientia, in the sense of thoughtfulness and awareness, disciplina, understood as love for a self-given law and form, fides, in the specifically Roman sense of loyalty and faithfulness, and dignitas, which in the ancient patrician society became gravitas and solemnitas, a studied and moderate seriousness. The Roman spirit preferred deliberate actions, without grand gestures, a realism that is love for the essential, clarity, an inner equilibrium and a healthy suspicion of every confused form of mysticism, a love for boundaries, the readiness to unite, as free human beings and without losing one's identity, in view of a higher goal or for an idea, religio and pietas, which signify an attitude of respectful and dignified veneration for the gods and of trust and reconnection with the supernatural, which was experienced as omnipresent and effective. By contrast, Evola characterized the Mediterranean style much less favorably, seeing it as consisting of love for outward appearances and grand gestures, concern to be noticed by others and to make an impact on them, the choreographic, theatrical and spectacular, comparable to the French grandeur and gloire, the tendency toward a restless, chaotic and undisciplined individualism, intolerance of any general and strict law of order, the fireworks of a creativity disjoined from any higher meaning and tradition, the pseudo-genial hypercritic, expert in eluding a law, the cunning and malicious fooler of others, a gesticulating, noisy and disordered exuberance, a manic effusiveness, excitability and verbosity, a flaunted and conventional sense of honor, immediacy of desire or affection, and a public cheeriness masking an inner hopelessness. There is an element of caricature, of course, in this comparison of two poles, and Evola's ideal Roman is not the only fruitful way of being human, it is not a universal requirement of man. Nevertheless, Evola's discussion can alert us to the ways in which propagandists and agitators promote various stereotypes of the typical Australian or the Aussie bloke and Sheila, which may, in fact, be inadequately attuned to reality as well as psychosocially demeaning. The Australian right needs to determine its own modes of the ideal Australian character, based on scrupulous examination of our history and culture, and to promote these coolly and calmly in the public forums. As Evola also noted, there is no need to suppress passion, rather, we should heed Nietzsche's warning against every morality that tends to dry up every impetuous current of the human soul instead of channeling it. What matters is to organize one's being in an integral way around the capability of recognizing, discriminating and adequately utilizing the impulses and the lights that emerge from one's deep recesses. For Evola, the myth of Rome was Italy's most desirable model. In the rectifying and formative action, the key role will always be played by the political myth, a galvanizing idea force. The myth reacts on the environment, implementing the law of elective affinities, it awakens, frees and imposes those possibilities of single individuals and the environment to which they correspond. Sex and population. Evola believes in the need for humanity to control the world's population growth. Overpopulation exacerbates the problem of how to employ the workforces, it also unavoidably intensifies production processes, which in turn, due to their determinisms, strengthen the demonic nature of the economy. The result is the increasing enslavement of the individual and the reduction of free space and of any autonomous movement in modern cities. Evola also mentions the congestion that in turn produces critical international solutions, a theme that Jean Rospy later took up in his novel The Camp of the Saints, and a reality that now poses headaches for the Australian government as regards immigration policy. Evola takes up a number of controversial and uncompromising positions. In the first place, he endorses the view that some peoples are superior to others and that the political order of the state should appropriately reflect this. Every true empire is born from a race of conquerors who overcame lands and peoples on the basis of a higher calling and qualification, which allowed them to rule as a minority in foreign lands. The Romans, the Achaemenids, the Franks, the Spaniards, the early Islamic hosts and the British. In the second place, he rejects as outdated and in fact immoral the Catholic religion's embrace of the biblical principle of the multiplication of the human species and the Church teaching that sexual union and marriage are legitimate and sanctified only when they are aimed at procreation. Evola acknowledges the good sense of a Vatican II declaration that love, too, may be a legitimate foundation of marriage. In referring also to the libertine, who elevates pleasure to an art, and the Dionysianism that in antiquity enjoyed a religious sanction, Evola clearly insists that birth control measures should be widely employed so that sexual satisfaction of various intensities can be obtained without worsening the population problem. A third controversial position concerns the identification of the cult of children with the bourgeois spirit. Evola calls for men to join the revolutionary conservative movement who should almost look upon creating a family as a betrayal of the cause. He perhaps mistakes a personal preference for an ideal. Such men are not necessarily to be ascetics. I believe that in the personal domain the right to an ample degree of sexual freedom for these men should be acknowledged, against moralism, social conformism and heroism in slippers. A degree of personal feeling has clearly entered the discourse here, confirmed by A. Voller's approving quotation of Nietzsche's infamous dictum that man should be trained for war and woman for the recreation of the warrior. At the same time, A. Voller must be commended for his courage and frankness in tackling such difficult subjects in defiance of taboos old or new. The Australian right will need to show similar integrity in determining policy on immigration and population issues for our future. A true European Union, A. Voller's last chapter considers the daunting task of bringing about a united Europe in accordance with the principles of tradition. This is of great interest in a time when a quite different kind of European Union is being more or less forced on the peoples of the traditional European nations, and when Britain is moving towards its fateful referendum on whether or not to accept the euro as its unit of currency. A. Voller begins by outlining the organic character that his ideal Europe would possess. Fatherlands and nations may exist. What should be excluded are nationalism, imperialism, chauvinism, every fanatical absolutization of a particular unit. Such a European empire would safeguard the principles of both unity and multiplicity. Individual states would have the character of partial organic units, gravitating around the one that is not a part. Transcending the political sphere would be an idea, a tradition and a spiritual power. The limitations of the sovereignty of the single national units before an eminent right of the empire will have as their sole condition this transcendental dignity of the empire, an organism composed of organisms. Thus, the elementary presupposition of an eventual united Europe appears to be the political integration of the single nations. A healthy whole cannot be made up of unhealthy parts. In such integrated nations, quite different from the current bourgeois democracies, the elites of each nation could understand one another and coordinate their work, rather in the manner of the royal houses and their supporting aristocracies in the old Europe. A. Voller does not fudge the disheartening magnitude of the task, which seems almost utopian. He notes that the problem of finding a spiritual foundation for such a European empire is quite unresolved. Neither Catholicism nor a generic Christianity would serve the purpose. Moreover, Europeans have largely lost contact with the highest meaning of Europe itself, and European tradition and European culture are too confused and too contaminated by false ideas. A. Voller is aware that the general leveling of cultures of the world has been used as an argument by those who do not want a united Europe but rather a unified world, in a supranational organization or world government. Today's European Union, brought about by massive deceit in recent decades, is perhaps a step in that direction. It would, of course, lead to an anti-traditional world in which the majority of human beings would be drugged and driven serfs. A. Voller adds that a radical European action finds its major obstacle in the lack of something that could represent a starting point, a firm support and a center of crystallization. He proposes the creation of an order whose members would work in the right direction in the various nations. Such an order could include members of ancient European families, warrior types and other persons in whom a distaste for the modern disaster has aroused a yearning for a traditional political order, together with the will and character to strive for it. The personality of an authentic leader at the center and head of the order is of the utmost importance. No such person was visible to A. Voller in Europe as he wrote those words. For members of the Australian right, this chapter reminds us of the kind of political order in Australia towards which we should work, together with the attendant difficulties. To date, it seems that no suitable leader arose during the 5 decades after the Japanese collapse, but perhaps that reflects the fact that individuals and groups on the Australian right lacked the wisdom and understanding to create the necessary atmosphere in which such a leader could appear and act. Envoy, the most arresting question to be asked of A. Voller is whether or not he ever wrote as an initiate, as an awakened man, as a Brahmin. Judging by men among the ruins, I believe the answer to be no. A not altogether friendly critic of Evola, Richard Drake, in Chapter 7 of his Revolutionary Mystique and Terrorism in Contemporary Italy, has written of Evola's period of magical studies with the Ur group in the 1920s as follows: Evola proposed a philosophy of utter wakefulness and vigilance on this plane of existence, the only one with which he was seriously concerned. This was after Evola had left the Ur group. And Dr. H. D. Hansen, in a short introduction to Julius Evola published in Theosophical History, noted of Evola, since he does not regard himself as master, he can recognize no student. Evola's behavior in 1945 is also in consonant with that of a wise initiate. Hansen reported, during air attacks, Evola had the habit of not going to the bomb shelters but instead went on working in his office or walked about the streets of Vienna. He wanted, as he said, calmly to question his fate. In fact, it was foolish negligence, and he suffered terribly for it. Robin Waterfield, the biographer of Gainon, published Baron Julius Evola and the Hermetic Tradition in Gnosis magazine. About the Ur phase, he tersely commented, their attempts to form a magical Chang in order to exercise supernatural influence on others were soon abandoned. Waterfield felt that Evola had, however, performed a service by bringing back to European attention the concept of theosis, personal deification, that level of attainment known as Jivan Mukta in Hinduism, the superior person in Chinese tradition, the liberated one in Buddhism and the saint or sage in Christian tradition. This notion has been fiercely opposed by the hierarchical Christian church, whose clergy have seen unmediated access to divine grace as a threat to their influence and power.